It is approximately time to begin, or close enough for our purposes. Little housekeeping before I dive into the notes tonight. Used to, my boss was named Karen, and now my boss is named Yvonne, and so I just do what I'm told. I was given this clipboard. We're fixing to print the next directory that we do a couple times a year, and she wanted to be sure that addresses were correct before she hit print on four or five dozen of them, or however many she prints. So this clipboard, alphabetically by last name, just has your information, and there's a little green pen. If you could just put a check mark by it, I'm going to pass it around during class. It'll give you an excuse not to listen to me. Just when the clipboard comes around, put a check by it that your information is correct. It would be, it's helpful if you actually read it before you put the check mark there. And I won't name names, but last time there were some that had check marks by them that still told us they were wrong. So read them, and then put the check mark, and then we'll hit print. James is going to say a word of prayer, and then we'll get started with our class tonight. Go ahead, James. We're in lesson three out of the book we're covering, which is about churches being evangelistically oriented all the way through, top to bottom. And this chapter is cleverly titled Members Only. Just to give you a heads up, he's not in favor of that. He's saying that's the problem sometimes, is people get the perception, if you don't have a card somewhere that has, you know, Church of Christ punched on it, maybe we don't let you in the door. And we need to make sure that people from the outside feel able and are able to get from where they are to here into discipleship and learning about Christ, right? That's the goal, is to help them come through that process. And if they think they can't get through the front door, then there's a problem. No one here says that. No one wakes up in the morning and says, let's make sure we keep all the other folks out. But it can happen without planning. So the story he gives at the beginning of the chapter I think is pretty fun. And he talks about being in Central America in a country that was Spanish-speaking. And I think he was doing some mission work. And he was invited to a local wedding of someone in town that was having a wedding. You're going to guess, now this is Central America, Spanish-speaking country, Roman Catholic, heavily influenced. So the wedding is in a Roman Catholic church. So besides the fact that he's still learning Spanish, now he goes over to this wedding to be, you know, a good member of the community. He goes and participates, and he's there. And now everything's in Latin, in addition to the Spanish barrier. And he said, I felt so out of place that there were people here who knew what happened next. A Roman Catholic wedding is at least partially a mass, because weddings are a sacrament in the same way for them communion or baptism is. So it's a religious ceremony from top to bottom, very formalized. They're standing and sitting in participation by the audience and the whole bit. And he said, I didn't know what I was supposed to do. And I always found myself standing when I was supposed to be sitting, or sitting when I was supposed to be standing. And it was really awkward. He says, being in a religious ceremony with rules and terms you don't understand can be very intimidating. Okay? Now, you may not feel that way about ours, because a lot of us, though not all of us, grew up in something like this, or at least have been coming to this one long enough that we kind of know how our routine goes. But for a lot of visitors, we might as well be speaking a different language. They're unfamiliar with the unspoken rules of kind of what to do in a worship assembly. And that can be a barrier for them in terms of reaching out in evangelism. So he comments, most visitors don't want to offend, nor do they want to be moved outside of their comfort zone. We know our churches to be safe, welcoming places, but visitors aren't sure of that yet. And that's kind of one of the problems that folks have in coming into church, or us helping to get them there. Think of some of the things that happen in our worship assembly, which are unspoken rules that we just take for granted folks know, which in fact a guest might not know. When it's time for our music portion of the worship service, are you expected to sing or to listen to someone else sing? Well, we would know, if you've been to Churches of Christ, that participation is actually very normal, not to the point of being expected, right? Get out a songbook and turn two. We're expecting you to do something. But you also know there are a lot of places where that's not normal, is it? Where participation is actually rare. So for someone to come in, they might not know. And they're a little unsure of themselves. Is it okay to respond during the service? Do we shout amen and jump up and down? Do we quietly nod and shake our heads? What about during readings? If you grew up, for example, in a Presbyterian church, when the scripture reading is done, it's in the bulletin. And so when the scripture reading is done, everyone stands and they read the scripture and you read along with it. This is God's word, amen. And then you say the creeds together and things like that. And so someone comes in, well, am I going to be expected to stand up and say something? What's going to happen? Do we have open or close communion? Those are terms most folks don't even know, but different churches have different thoughts on that out there in the broader religious world. In other words, if I am a guest here, is it okay for me to take membership? Is someone going to slap my hand if I try to take communion? I said membership. If I take communion, is it okay? Should I not? Will I be rude if I don't take it? What happens when the tray gets passed around? Do I give or pass? What about money? Is that usher going to hold that plate in front of me till I cough up enough to make him go on? I mean, those are unspoken. Now, we know what happens, and none of that is intimidating to us, but to someone who comes in from different backgrounds may not be. Okay, so that's the kind of thing we're talking about. It can be tough being a visitor. And for us, it's hard to understand how tough it is because we have what Archer calls the curse of knowledge. And knowledge is usually a good thing, but in this case, it can be tough. Because we know what's going on, it's hard for us to notice what other folks don't know about what's going on. And he gives this example, which is kind of a funny study. There was a Stanford research study. And they had the people in the study tap out a song. Tap out the beat to a song. And then someone else listened. And they had to write down what they thought the song was. And then they asked the tappers, how often do you think they guessed the song right based on your tapping? And the tappers said, well, probably about half of them. In actuality, it was 2.5%. 3 out of 120 was normal. You can hear it in your head. I mean, I hear jingle bells, obvious. Didn't you all get that? I mean, it was obvious. But that's because the song's in my head. I can hear it. I know it. You don't. You don't know that's what's in my head. In a church service, we kind of know how it goes. We know the routine. We've been to these before. Ones like this one. But for a guest, we don't even know what they don't know, what they feel awkward about, or things they assume. Maybe they think they know. They hear the word baptism, and they say, oh, I know what that is. But then you want to do you know what baptism? Different people say different things about baptism. Maybe they hear the word and think something completely different. Okay? So that's kind of what we're trying to talk about today. And the question that comes in response to that has kind of taken two forms in most churches. Some churches have opted for what's sometimes called a seeker-oriented service. So I'm going to give you two extremes. Most churches are somewhere in between, but just to kind of make my point, two extremes. A seeker-oriented service, they think our main service on Sunday exists to get people in and to help them feel okay here. So the aim of the service is to make people feel comfortable and desire to come back, to make that connection. It is, in the seeker's person's mind, it's an evangelistic effort. Okay, so what they're going to do is they're going to look at their service from top to bottom and say, everything has to be aimed at the potential guest, from start to finish. The other kind of extreme, I call it a worship service because I don't have another name for it, but this would be to say, the worship service is intended for members. We'd kind of prefer no one else showed up anyway. We're going to do our thing. We don't care if anybody understands it. This is just the way it's going to be. If you've ever attended, I'll give you two kind of examples of that, two extremes. A seeker service, if you attend maybe a life church, something like that, it is a seeker-friendly service. From start to finish, they got the greeters in the parking lot. They got the people taking you where you need to go. They're telling you on the screen what to do next. You don't need to participate. You feel comfortable. You sit down. Everything. There's no question of whether you're a member here or not. They just want you to be comfortable here and come back. Okay? The opposite extreme would be like a Roman Catholic Mass, where we don't really care if you understand a word we say. This is what we do for worship, start to finish. Okay? Those are two extremes. Most churches are somewhere in between. What is the biblical model for our worship assembly? That's our question tonight. What are we trying to accomplish, and how do we do that? And as you might guess, it's neither one of these options, right, at the far ends of the spectrum. There's a biblical model in between for what we try to accomplish, especially in our Sunday morning service, where we're going to have, just be candid, we're going to have the highest frequency of guests, highest turnout of our own members. What are we trying to accomplish there? And, conveniently, we have a few verses that give us some hints as to what to do. Turn, for starters, to James chapter 2, verses 1 through 5. James chapter 2, 1 through 5. When someone gets there, if you'd raise your hand, I'll pick on you to read. James chapter 2, 1 through 5. James, go ahead. So I'm, without doing a full study of James here in the time we have available, I'm going to go out on a limb and assume he's describing kind of a typical Christian worship service of some kind. They get together for some reason. How does he describe it? If a man comes into your assembly, and he doesn't say what kind of assembly, I'm just guessing, typical, James is probably one of the three or four earliest books of the New Testament to be written. So, an early church having a typical early worship service, whatever, you know, whatever these first early Christians did, this is it. They have some kind of assembly. Question number one, do they expect guests? I mean, that's the hypothetical set forward. I mean, to be clear, he's not answering our question. He's answering a different question about their behavior. But what we can say is, at least in this hypothetical, does he anticipate that there might be some guests show up? Well, sounds like it. There's two people, and in the way it's described, again, he's not real detailed, but there's two people, and you don't know much about them but this, the way they dress. One of them has the gold ring. That's fun, too. I'm really trying to get off topic, but I love James. The text doesn't have the word ring in it. It says he has gold fingers. He's got so many rings on his fingers. He's just got a golden hand. And his clothes, they're not fine clothing. They are shiny clothing. He comes in, he's sparkly. He's got a gold hand. He is sequined from top to bottom, and he glistens when he walks. It's kind of, you know, exaggeration that James says. This guy comes in, and he is just top to bottom, ridiculous wealth. And then this other guy comes in, and James uses a word for him. Shabby clothing is also not a really good translation. The word there is smelly clothing. He comes in and he actually reeks. Okay, so one guy comes in and he's just oozing wealth and propriety. The other guy comes in and he literally smells. And so what do we do? James's problem that he's discussing is you're treating them different. But for our point, do the Christian assemblies expect to sometimes have guests that they don't know anything else about except there they are? And the answer is, yeah, they do. I don't know how often they had guests in their assemblies in the first century, right? I don't know. I don't think they had a building with a marquee out front in Jerusalem that said, first service at 9:30, right? I don't think there was anything quite that obvious, so I don't know how visitation, but people apparently sometimes came in. Maybe it's because they did it in public places. If the church was meeting in the synagogue, anybody might wander in. Or they might have invited people. If it's in someone's home, hey, come over here and listen to what we have to say in the morning. I want you to hear about Jesus. Come over with me. That sounds very reasonable to me. So they expect people to come in. And then the second point, not only are guests expected in this world we're describing, but how Christians act toward guests in their assembly matters to God. James could have said, a man comes into your assembly, why didn't you throw him out? Of course, he doesn't say that. Instead, he says, there is a right and a wrong way to treat people that come into your assembly, and by the way, you're doing it wrong. The sin he describes here is called partiality. Treating one person based on a wealth and appearance differently than another person in the room. So he says, in Christian assemblies, we don't do that. Somebody comes in, we don't show partiality. That's not one of the things we do. So that's not a lot of information to answer our question, but it's a start that kind of helps to start paint a picture of what might a worship service look like in the New Testament. The next passage we want to look at gives us a little more, and this is in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. 1 Corinthians is a book that mostly from start to finish, at least from about chapter 7-ish through to about chapter 14, so the heart of the book deals with what you do when you get together. There's a question about what ladies should wear based on Jewish customs of the day and issues in Corinth. There's a question about when you take communion together. There's a question about, in chapter 14, how many people are allowed to talk at once. We mentioned this passage actually last week a little bit. And the routine of service. Two passages here we're going to read. The first one is verses 5 through 12 of 1 Corinthians 14. Who has that for us and would like to read? 1 Corinthians 14, 5 through 12. Bobby, thank you. Okay, so there's a whole lot going on in that section that might sound a little foreign to us. Okay, so the problem with the tongue speaking in Corinth, that's not one I preach about a lot, right? The problem with the tongue speaking here at Glenpool, that's not a common sermon for me. So it's a little foreign to us for good reason. But there are some points there that are worth mentioning. In discussing their practice of speaking in tongues in the assembly, who is Paul concerned with? And who does he say their worship and behavior is directed towards in this part of the passage? And hence, the end of verse 5 and the end of verse 12. So in this part of the chapter, and this isn't all he's going to say, but in this part of the chapter, he says, we come together and this is supposed to build up the church. There are people that are here every week And they are supposed to be benefited by what takes place. To be edified is the word we use, right? To be built up. They're supposed to be growing in their knowledge. So that's his complaint about their fascination with tongue speaking. He says, well, that's fine and all, but if no one understands what you're saying, is anybody growing? I mean, it makes a fantastic spectacle, but is anybody actually benefited unless we know what you're saying? And so the church, he says twice, the church is to be built up by our worship service. And that would be my complaint about one of those extremes we talked about, churches that are so focused on let's get the members in, or let's get the visitors in and get them to feel comfortable and kind of the lowest common denominator, and that's the goal of every assembly, is they seem to ignore Paul's point that one of the functions of the worship assembly, not the only one, but one of them, is to build up the membership. And things that don't do that are a problem for Paul. He says, what you're doing, he doesn't even say they're not correctly speaking in tongues. He just says you're doing it in a way that is not edifying, and it's supposed to be. Okay? Second thing in this passage, somebody wants to read verse 16, first of all. Verse 16, same opening. Edwin, thank you. What translation do you have? Just curious.
New King James
says the uninformed. ESV translates that as outsider. And I'm not, to be honest, I didn't look it up to see which slant on that I prefer. But something along those lines of someone who does not know what's going on. Wasn't that the problem we discussed at the beginning of class? Someone's there and they don't know what's going on. Well, they're never going to figure it out if you are speaking in tongues and no one's interpreting, and it just goes on. Okay. Somebody else, verses 22 through 25. Jeff, thank you. This, to me, is the clearest path, even as strange as the context is the clearest passage in answering our question, what do we expect out of a worship service? What should be expected? And he mentions both things. That's not one or the other. He does talk about, will there be outsiders in your assembly? Yeah, he says that's going to be something that you should be concerned with, even to the extent that you might change your behavior to make sure that they know what's going on. On the other hand, is everything done to satisfy an outsider? No, he says, in fact, this other thing we do called prophecy is teaching and edification. One is a spectacle that kind of draws attention to itself for the purpose of someone who doesn't believe. The other is to instruct and teach someone who does. And even the one that, this is interesting, even the one that attracts outsiders, he says, will then confuse outsiders if it's not done well. I love that translation that most of them have. They're going to look at you and say, you've lost your mind, right? They're going to say, you're out of your mind. And so Paul has a two-pronged discussion here about what should take place in our assemblies. One of the goals is to do things that build up the congregation, the membership, but the other is to be aware that there will sometimes be people here who don't know what's going on, and they shouldn't immediately walk away thinking these people are nuts. That what we do has enough sense to it that they could decipher it and say, okay, I kind of get what you're doing. I don't get all of it. I don't buy in yet, but I get what you're doing. I knew what was expected of me. And then verse 25, just to recap what that said, the secrets of his heart are disclosed, and so, falling on his face, he will worship God and declare that God is really among you. The third thing that you'll notice we haven't mentioned even yet tonight, but should not be overlooked, who is worship directed towards? So I think that is where Paul ends his discussion, and sometimes the discussion never gets there. we're aware that guests will be in our assembly. We are trying to build up the membership. But in all things, we are worshiping God, and he is to be praised. And that has to have priority. So my argument, if you ask me what should we think about the assembly? What's it geared towards? None of these extreme actually work. There are three things that have to be kept in mind. Members should be built up. Outsiders should find it at least accessible. But above all, God should be glorified. Those three things, you're supposed to have three people in your assembly. Members, guests, and God. Those three people are supposed to be there in this passage. And we need to keep that in mind. So, what we're going to look at now are suggestions from the book. Does anyone remember our first lesson where I said, he'll have some suggestions and we'll like some of them and not others? We're there now. So we're just going to take a look at some of his suggestions. And what I'm going to suggest is just kind of take them and consider them. And we'll discuss them a little bit. Some of them we'll like and some of them we'll say, eh, maybe not so much. But that's entirely just the way it goes. So suggestions from the book. He says the number one complaint among church guests is when the spotlight is put on them, when they're singled out in some way. Now, this is a delicate thing to do, because to be hospitable, of course we want to make people feel welcome. And if we fail to make people feel welcome, well, then we didn't do the other thing we're trying to do. But his complaint, he spends like a whole page on it. He is very leery of putting spotlight on guests in a way that makes them feel uncomfortable. So some churches I've known do kind of the, like, oh, what did grandma call it? Howdy doody, that's what she called it. She said, yeah, our church has howdy doody time now, as my grandma said. Anyway, and what she meant was the beginning of service, everyone stood up and you went and found a guest and you went and shook their hand and made a big deal about it. And if you're a guest, there's all these people running at you and trying to get to know you in 5 minutes because they're supposed to. And it was really intimidating. Even Stafford North's book that I have in my office on evangelism, I think sometimes he's supposed to be kind of one of our experts on evangelism, and I think sometimes he crosses that line in his suggestions. You notice we put visitor parking spaces out here. I think that's good. Okay, here's where you can park. Memorial Road in Edmond, where he is one of the elders, also has a visitor's entrance. So there's like a special door you come through if you don't belong there. It's the way it feels to some of the guests, you know, okay? And so they have these people there that then kind of pounce on you. And his philosophy is, you make your first impression in the parking lot. So they're out there getting their kids out of the car, and here comes Stafford, and he's ready for you to get back in your car, is what some people feel like. Okay, so there is a very fine line, and I don't know what it is. This is not an area where I am an expert. But there's a very fine line between making people feel like we have hospitality and look at you, everyone's looking at you, and that scares people away. That is a very fine line. And so churches have to make decisions all along the way of how to do that. One way you do that when people come in is respect for personal space. Okay? Just be aware. Some people, I'm a hula hoop person. I have a little hula hoop around me of personal space. You get too close to the hula hoop, I'm uncomfortable, right? Some people have no hula hoop, and that's fine, but you just kind of have to look at people and say, am I making them feel uncomfortable? Okay. Look for clues of how much interaction they're comfortable with. They usually kind of give you an idea. Now, this for me is an area where I do have a little bit of experience, so I can tell stories about the years I was trying to get out of being a minister, and God kept throwing me back in. I was a furniture salesman, and I was the annoying guy at the door who waited in a 30-minute line for you to tell him, I don't need any help. Okay, that was my job. So I waited in line, and you see this person coming through the door, and you've got, at best, 10 to 30 seconds to make some kind of connection with them so that they don't turn around and leave because you're obnoxious, and that they remember you later when they find a sofa they like and they ask for you again. Well, Ben was helping me. You got 10 to 30 seconds. That's it. And you did everything you could possibly do. I mean, you looked at if they had an OU shirt on. You talked about the game. I made it a rule. I didn't talk about furniture for the first 2 or 3 minutes if they would let me. I would talk about the game. I'd talk about that your kids. I'd talk about my kids. And I would just kind of follow them around and talk about the weather. And then, oh, by the way, do you guys want furniture? You're in a furniture store, you know. and we would get to that eventually, but I would try to figure out, do they want to be left alone? Listen, the managers never understood this, but salesmen did. If someone says, leave me alone, it doesn't matter how polite you are, they want you to leave them alone. And the manager would say, well, go sell them something. They're going to punch me. I don't want to do it. But you have to kind of learn and to read people and say, this guy really wants to be left alone. And people come in and they have their mind made up. Guy comes in. I'll tell this one story and then I'll get the rest of my notes. Guy comes in, he and his wife. I think they had been fighting in the parking lot, which, by the way, happens a lot outside of furniture stores. We were about the third furniture store they had visited. I think they were fighting in the parking lot. They come in. He's in a huff. She's in a huff behind him. And I say, hi, can I? And things said that I'll not repeat. And off they go through the back of the store. And I look at him and I say, I know who that guy is. And so, at a considerable distance, so I didn't get punched, I followed kind of back to where they were going, and I waited till they had kind of found a clear looking for dining room tables. I wait, and I wait. There are things I'd like to tell them about it. I don't say anything, because I don't want to be punched. Finally, he kind of looks like he gets to that moment where he's looking for somebody. Right? He's now confused. He wants to know, does this come with four chairs, or are the chairs separate? And I know he wants to know that, because everyone who looks at that set wants to know it, because it's not clearly marked. And I know the answer, but they don't need my help, right? But I wait until he knows he doesn't know. And he's looking around, and he's just going to grab somebody, but there's that guy he didn't like at the door. And he says, hey, about this. I said, Jason, if you just ask me, I'd tell you. It was the preacher's kid from Seminole where I grew up, and his wife. And he had no idea it was me. He blew right past me and had known me for years, and because he had in his head, he was upset, he was angry, he was there, that's a salesman. What I'm telling you is people come through that door, and they have a set of expectations. Well, here comes some church people. We shouldn't have come anyway. They had a fight in the parking lot because the kids didn't have their shoes on this morning, and we don't know what we're having for lunch, and all the things that young family, see, Rebecca's laughing, all the things that we do in the parking lot, right? And they come in, and you want to love on them and embrace them, and you just have to be aware. They walk in, they may need a little space, but they may also have a question. At some point, they're going to look around and want to know where the bathroom is. And you just try to be aware of them. It's down here. Do you need help finding a seat? I can ask the bowlers to move. Do you need a spot? You know, you're going to be helpful. No. But you're going to be helpful at that point and try to help them, but you just kind of have to be aware. Greeters are good, but insufficient, is what Archer says in the books. He says churches ought to have them, but you can't delegate hospitality, right? Members have to be kind, period. If you have really nice people in the foyer and jerks in the auditorium, it doesn't matter, right? People have to be kind. Look for lost expressions or confusion. People get in here and they do get lost. They don't know what's going on. I had a guy who told me he grew up in a Church of Christ. That's what he told me. And he came in about halfway through Bible class, and at the end of it, I knew him, and he said, what was that we just did? Does that sound like an odd question? He didn't understand, was that the worship for today and I missed it? Was that something you do before worship and I was just late? He didn't know what it was. And so I see a lost look, and, hey, how you doing? He goes, what was that we just did? And I get to talk to him a minute. So just kind of be aware of, yes, somebody looks lost and confused, help, and be respectful. Another thing we can do that is like pulling teeth is to make bulletins and announcements concise. So let me take a moment and tell you how the cow eats the cabbage. All right? This is the way it has to be. There are 200 people on a regular Sunday morning, and all of them want something announced. It can't work that way. Every announcement is important. We care about each and every one of you. But we can't say in the course of 3 minutes everything that everybody wants said. Even if you put it on a note and hand it to us right before we get up there, sometimes we have to ignore it. Sometimes if you send us something for the bulletin, as Karen will attest, and now Yvonne, there is so much page space. And that preacher insists on putting Bible stuff in there once in a while, so that cuts down on the amount of page space. And there's only so much and so many words that you can use. And worse, if you fill up every square inch of that with information, you lose the information. You ever looked at a document that just had so much information on it, you thought, I don't even want to start. Right? the church bulletin can't be that way. So one of the things, I don't know if you probably noticed, the bulletin looks a little different after Friends and Family Day or right before we made a few changes. And the goal was to kind of simplify it so we had stuff for members that they could find the things they need. But also, if you're a guest, like the critical information, when's your next service, what is happening now, was easier to locate. And we're going to probably try, it's going to take several attempts to figure out how to do that because of the problem we talked about earlier. I know what's going on, so it's hard for me to understand what you don't know is going on, right? But making that concise, making the announcements concise. So Karen's back, so I can tell this story too. Is that Karen and I go through several rounds of this when she was secretary, that she'd get the announcements, and then she'd cut some stuff out, and then I'd sneak in behind her and I'd cut some more stuff out. And then the guy with the announcement clipboard would add some stuff. And then Karen would go by and mark some stuff. And then I'd mark some stuff. It's a process, and it's a challenge. Poor Bobby Hill, when he makes announcements, feels like he has to tell everybody's life story when he does it. And it's just hard for him. Well, that's just hard. I'm kidding, Bobby. I'm kidding a little bit. It's hard to make short announcements. We have more people that are willing. Ask James Hamilton. We have more people that are willing to say prayers than give announcements. Because it's not a fun job to figure out how do you whittle that much information down clearly and concisely and get it done and move ahead. It's hard. But it's one of the challenges we have. The book also had some questions to kind of go along with this. Moving ahead here. To beware of terminology. This mostly reflects to me, but also to Bible class teachers, people who have speaking parts in our worship service. There are a lot of words we use that people don't get. Some of that is just the way it is. I can't reinvent the wheel and give us all new words that everyone knows. There are only so many words for baptism that I can use that people are going to understand. I could say immersion every time, I guess, but it's not like you really say immersion a lot anyway. Elders and deacons, well, that's kind of what they're called. I could call them shepherds and servants, and sometimes I do to kind of mix it up and to give a descriptive term that I hope maybe somebody would pick up on that didn't understand, I don't know what an elder is. Well, they're our overseers. And sometimes I'll use different words to try to help define words that I know might be unclear to outsiders. But you just have to be aware that you know a complete list of vocabulary that other people may not. We use phrases. Here's my favorite. We will now lay by in store as God has prospered us. There is no place in the world you will ever use that expression except at that table, right? And I know where it comes from. It comes from the King James, and it was the way our fathers taught us to pray. I mean, that's the way you say this. We will now lay by in store as God has prospered us. It comes right out of the text. But that is an expression that is really unclear. What does that even mean to a guest who has no knowledge of what we're talking about? You never go to the bank and say, I'm here to lay by in store as God has prospered me. You've never done it. And so just be aware of phrases that we use. And all of them. Do we need to start, Lenora, on our favorite expressions? I mean, what are they? Guide, guard, and direct us, and give him a ready recollection of the things. I mean, there are certain phrases that just kind of come up, and we've heard them so many times, we know what they mean, and there we go. And for some, it's obtuse.
Be sure to use unto.
Unto. Use the phrase unto as often as possible. Because how often do you say unto in normal speech? I say unto all the time, Lenora. I say it unto you. Be aware of unintentional insults. No one gets up and teaches a Bible class and says, some of y'all are stupid, okay? But sometimes we say things that sound like that. When you say, as we all know, and there's a guest there that has no idea where the book of Matthew is, let alone what you're talking about, you just said, you're a dummy who doesn't belong here, okay? We all know in the church that the following. They may not know. That's kind of the point. They're here because they don't know anything. And we're going to have to kind of come to grips with that reality. And so just be aware of the unintentional insult when you're speaking. Well, as we all know, except you guys. Don't say that. Beware of your audience. Not everyone in this room grew up in a church, let alone a Church of Christ. Not everyone in this room is a member of this or any other church. Okay? We just have to be aware of that when people come in, that that's who we're talking to, and assume that when we're speaking. And it is hard. It is incredibly difficult. As a person who does it pretty much all the time, I'm here to tell you it is incredibly difficult to do. But being aware of that in your speech is very important. A couple more points here. balance is important. It would be impossible to explain every act and every word on every Sunday. Okay? Can you imagine if the song leader gets up every Sunday and says, we're now going to sing. It's going to be congregational singing using four-part harmony. This is based on the instructions of Ephesians 5 and verse 19. We're going to use the songs developed from the rich history of Christianity back several hundred years, but these have been looked over by the song leader and selected with an eye towards scriptural edification. If he gives this speech every time he gets up, we're going to have a three-hour worship service, and it won't be because I preached too long. See, I saw you saying that. It's going to be because we had too much explanation. Yeah. It would be impossible to get rid of every act and word, which might be difficult to outsiders. I don't want to stop saying baptism. I kind of like that word. I think I'm going to hang on to it. I'm going to use it, and I'm going to try my best to explain it from time to time. But there are some words, we just can't get rid of all the difficult words. Some of them we're going to have to work with. But not adding unnecessary ones is going to be helpful. How do we balance our goal of edifying members with allowing access to outsiders, and then I'll add, while glorifying God, is the challenge that we're kind of up against. So we've got 4 minutes. So let's do a real quick self-assessment. I'm not going to try to answer all these questions. I want you to answer in your head. That means don't yell at me. Just answer in your head and think about this self-assessment, about a 10-point self-assessment. You show up and you've never been here before. Where do I park? This is, by the way, his list of questions. I didn't come up with these. Where do I park is question number one. For us, parking is getting to be a little bit of a problem. We're going to have to do something about it because we've got less spots than we got people some days. And some of them are in the back, right? There's a reason. It wasn't because we wanted to displace people who like to park over here, put the visitor spots there, because we didn't want the people who were thinking about going back home anyway to have to find a spot in the back. Okay, so we're trying to help. Where do I enter? This is more of a challenge for the delivery guys than it is for our members. Most of the guests figure out the big doors there, kind of obvious. The delivery guy never has found the office door. We have to wave at him and chase him down, but in any event, I think we do okay on that. Can I find a Bible class? Oh, yeah, what's a Bible class? I mean, what is happening at 9:30, and what am I supposed to do? Where am I supposed to be? It's fantastic, Edwin, that we have class here in the auditorium. We have a young families class. We might, on some quarters, have a college class, and then we have age-appropriate classes for the kids. That's fantastic if people can get there. We know in our mutated building that's been added onto a couple different times, right? Kind of which hallway to go down and where to find a room. And the signs are up, and that helps. But you're looking for those lost expressions on people. If you see a guy walking around with three kids walking down the hallway like this, he's not just looking, you know, for fun. He's trying to find something. Can I find a seat? Can my entire family sit together? So I know the specs on this auditorium, and I know how many seats are in it and how many we can fit. That is not the same as how many people can sit together at one time. There may be 55 seats available, but are there five together for a family that comes in at 10:35 to find one? And if there is, will you notice, and are you willing to get up and scoot down or move or whatever it takes? Hey, come here. Because we've seen them. This is not hypothetical. Who get as far as that door, the only seats for five are the front row where the sinners go. I have watched them walk back out that door. Okay? It does happen. And so being aware of that and being able to say, hey, there's a spot here between Rebecca and Kenneth. We could fit five people in here. A couple more questions. Are announcements only what is necessary? Not even going to look at Bobby. Are announcements only? No, it's a hard job. It really is. And anybody who dares to do it, good luck to you. But it's a challenge. Are bulletins clear to outsiders? Does it give them what they need to know about what's going on, that they might want to come back? Are worship expectations clear? Song leaders, if you want them to stand up, you got to say stand up. If you want them to sit down, you got to say sit down. Because not everybody knows. Stuff like that. I mean, do they know what they're supposed to do next? Are visitors unnecessarily spotlighted? Did we make you feel uncomfortable in some way just by walking in the door and trying to be hospitable? Did we pounce? Are members aware of guests? Did you notice them? And are slides readable? That one's not up to you. But I'll tell you, if you ever do end up working on slides for a class or anything like that, it is a challenge. It doesn't look the same up there as it does on your screen. You have to kind of come in here and field test a little bit and guess. Big letters is what I found. Less words, bigger letters. I try every week to. There's this much I want to say on a slide. This much that'll fit. So just keep deleting things. Questions or quick comments before the bell doorbell rings? Okay, great. Next week, I have to be in another thing here. Josh, I've written a completely complicated and confounded lesson, and Josh did such a good job with the last one, he's going to do this one. He's going to fill in for me next week about what is the tone of the congregation. So this was, when you come in, kind of what happens. The next, what is the tone of the congregation that it communicates? And that's an important lesson, too. Thanks for your attention and comments.